And now to introduce today's guest, please welcome Penn State Provost Dr. Rod Erickson.
Thank you, Katie, and good afternoon, everyone. Today, we're going to hear about the trails of digital data that we generate every day and what the data say about us. Every time we click web pages, shop with credit cards, and make cell phone calls, we're producing digital data. Many companies are employing mathematicians and computer scientists to analyze these data so they can predict and even influence what we want to buy or how we're likely to vote. Today's speaker, Stephen Baker, calls these math gurus the numerati. He wrote a 2006 cover story for Business Week about this trend and then expanded the story into a book, The Numerati, in 2008. One reviewer called it, quote, a bracing behind-the-screen investigation into the booming world of data mining and analysis, unquote. Stephen Baker earned a bachelor's degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a master's from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. He started his career at newspapers in Ludlow, Vermont, Caracas, Venezuela, and El Paso, Texas. Steve joined Business Week in 1987 as manager of the Mexico City Bureau, where he was responsible for covering Mexico and Latin America. He became the Pittsburgh Bureau manager in 1992, and later was a Business Week correspondent in Paris before returning to the States as acting senior editor and then senior writer. He's written for several other publications, including the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, and the Boston Globe. He also blogs at thenumerati.net. In all areas of our lives, data about us are accumulating, and organizations are trying to use it to understand and to influence us. How will the data be used, and will we recognize it when it happens? Should we be concerned about our privacy, or pleased that Amazon can recommend products that match our interests? The title of Steve's talk today is The Numerati, How Our Lives Will Be Monitored, Measured, and Managed in the Coming Age of Big Data. Please give a warm Penn State welcome to journalist and author Stephen Baker.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me here. It's a little bit of a homecoming for me. I'm from Philadelphia, and I raised my family in Pittsburgh, and I have two sons here. And I, you know, something about Penn State, I don't know whether it was Penn State's warm and generous spirit or some incredibly insightful algorithms at your admissions office, but you let my son Aiden in here a number of years ago, and he got his undergraduate education here, and now he's getting his PhD here in psychology. And my son Henry is with me here, and he's a senior in high school, and who knows, maybe he'll come here too. So a while back, I was reading Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi. I don't know if any of you have read that or remember it. But he was talking about the riverboat pilots on the Mississippi who learned every turn of the river, 2,000 miles of river, and they knew every turn, every area where a branch would jut out, every sandbank, and they kept that 2,000 miles of river running in their heads. And when somebody would come the other way on the river, they would question those people about changes in the river, about sandbanks that had changed the sides, about trees that had fallen over, and they would make a software update in their heads of all that information they had. It was like a Mississippi River app running in their heads. Now, if you talk to a pilot on the Mississippi today, and I haven't done so, but I can imagine that they don't need to keep that river running in their heads as much. They have machinery that handles that job for them. They have automatic sounding devices and whatnot to navigate the boat down the river with more automatically. And that raised the question to me about what we keep in our heads now that we're surrounded by this machinery that knows so much and provides so many answers to us. So which brain do you do most of your thinking with? the spongy one between your ears or the electronic monster that spans the globe that we all share? Which one holds your memories? Which one keeps track of your friendships? Which one do you look to for answers? I'm going to be returning to this theme today, but you know, a decade ago, it would have been very obvious that we did almost all of our important work with our own brain, which is the most sophisticated circuitry in the known piece of circuitry in the universe. But since then, there's been this explosion with the internet, and if you think about the host of global electronics that surround us and that serve us, and think of them as one ecosystem, that ecosystem is getting a whole lot smarter. In the late 90s, when search technology was, I won't say perfected, but made a big leap forward, it was as if that ecosystem developed a huge lobe for memory. With social networks, it's figuring out friendship. I bet there are computer scientists either here or within a mile or two of here who are busy teaching it how to look at photos and to recognize faces in photographs and to listen to or to read text in any language and to understand not only the keywords in those texts, but what people are trying to say. So it's figuring out the written word, too. Enormous amounts of scientific data are flooding into the networks. In the last year alone, we as a species created more digital data in biology than we had in the previous millennia of human history. This is an enormous resource that we're all using, but we're also feeding it. But if we, for one reason or another, chose to deprive ourselves of this electronic brain, it would be like volunteering for a partial lobotomy. You'd have to be an idiot. But at the same time, it is feeding off of us. It is learning from us. With every click, with every email we send, with every advertisement we look at, it's learning a little bit more about us. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today, is the relationship between these two information systems, the one we're born with and the one we share. And the question is how to manage them. There are all kinds of questions it brings up about privacy, about the role of the individual in society, about marketing and business. And it really boils down at some level to a question about resource management. How do we get the most for the brain power that we have access to? I'm just going to step back and talk about how I started in this whole data business, because I am the most unlikely person to be addressing you about anything that has to do with science or math. I was pretty much of a failure in math in high school, and I was lucky enough to go to college. Well, lucky. Maybe I would have learned a lot in a math class, but I considered myself lucky enough to go to college where I didn't have to study math, and I didn't. And I was a history major, and I also majored in Spanish, and that was my thing. And I was hired by Business Week to run the Mexico City Bureau. And I'm just going to parenthetically mention just something about what's great about journalism. I don't know if there are any journalism students or journalists here. It's a profession that's under siege by the very forces that I describe in my book, the engineering class. But it's a wonderful place to learn, because you can be ignorant in journalism, and that's a great luxury. And you have license to go find the most intelligent people in the whole world and ask them questions and ask them to pour out their knowledge for you. And often they do that. And the most important thing a journalist can do is to ask a really dumb question. It's embarrassing sometimes, but you have to ask dumb questions. And I basically built my career on asking dumb questions. But anyway, it gives you a chance to reinvent yourself. And that's what brought me here, is I was covering the steel industry in Pittsburgh, and my editors were losing interest. This was the mid-90s. My editors were losing interest in the steel stories that I was writing. And so I was in Pittsburgh. I began to kind of migrate up to University of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon and write about transplants and robots. And all of a sudden, I was getting more space for my stories. They were more interested in technology. And so I just switched into technology. And they sent me to Paris to cover technology in Europe and then back to New York. And I was at a cover meeting in New York, and I thought, I'm going to pitch a story about the decline of the U.S. tech industry, because my thesis was that we're graduating fewer engineers than China and India. We have a bad broadband network. We're behind in wireless. And I put together this whole list of ideas about why we were falling behind in technology. And I thought it would be a great cover story for Business Week. And my editor said, it sounds too familiar. We know that stuff. So they said, how else can we talk about this same subject but give it a fresh angle? So one of the editors said, why don't, you know, a central pillar in a lot of these competitive issues is mathematics. And the editor-in-chief, his eyes lit up, and he said, let's do a cover story on math. Nobody writes about math. It'll be a real change. It'll surprise people at, you know, Grand Central Station when they come and they see mathematics on Business Week. And the science editor said, well, we have a couple people that know a lot about math. And he started to point to a couple of our colleagues. And the editor-in-chief said, no, let's get somebody less brainy to do the story. So I start exploring the world of math, which I had really not dealt with since 11th grade. And I talk to the head of math at MIT. I talk to the New York University Courant School of Math. I go to Bell Labs and talk to mathematicians. And they're telling me all kinds of interesting things about math. But they're talking about optimizing cellular networks, the mathematics that's used in optimizing cellular networks or in industry or in trying to decode or, you know, to protect intellectual information. It's absolutely crucial. And for the Cold War, we had math wars against the Russians and went on and on. And I thought it was really interesting, but I didn't see a Business Week story. And then I went to IBM Labs north of New York City, and I talked to the head of stochastic analysis for IBM, a Syrian-born mathematician named Samer Tekriti. And he told me that he and his team were studying the data produced by 50,000 of their colleagues, all the data that they could get their hands on, and they were trying to build predictive mathematical models of their colleagues so that they could deploy them more efficiently and put them in teams with people they worked well with, put them in countries where they weren't allergic to much of the food. They wanted to scientifically understand the workers and deploy them according to these schemes. And I thought, if these people at IBM can go through data and figure out the workers and build predictive models of each worker, then other people in other industries must be able to look at the data that each of us is producing as shoppers and voters and patients and even potential terrorists, and they must be able to build predictive mathematical models of each one of us if they choose to. And that's when I got my math story, and it really was much more of a statistics and computer science story than a math story, but math has a role in all of these disciplines. And I thought, this is the mathematical modeling of humanity. This is going to be a huge endeavor for the 21st century, where we're going to be producing more and more data that describes what we're interested in, who we hang around with, what we like, where we go, and these mathematicians and their colleagues are going to be able to figure us out. And so that's the story that I pitched. And you know, I learned a lot as I worked on this story. And initially, I had this euphoria, this mathematical modeling of humanity. And later, I learned about things like garbage in, garbage out, and how much data is utter nonsense and can lead you on wild goose chases. But I still stick to my basic conclusion that I reached at that IBM, in IBM, that we are entering a different age in which the people that can handle the numbers for the first time in history really have a good grip on what have a grip and an ever-expanding grip on what humanity is up to. And that is going to change a lot of industries. It's already changed my industry in media, where Google, which is basically a company run by these people that I call the numerati, has turned our industry upside down because they know a lot about us and they can provide advertisers with much more relevant information and about each of us and with relevant access to each of us as we're surfing the web. And as a result of that, you know, media is having a real, the traditional media is having a real trouble and has to begin behaving more like the numerati themselves. And it's going to reach into medicine, and it's going to change the way police work. It's changing politics. And so that's what I wrote about in my book. Now, as I said, there's a lot of garbage in this data because it's just mountains and mountains of data. I went to Yahoo, and I talked to the head of research there, and he told me that they had 2,500 bits of information about each of Yahoo's 250 million users every month. Now, so they know 250 things about you if you're a Yahoo user, and that was a couple of years ago, so they might know 1,000 now. But a lot of that is perhaps not that important, and the real challenge for them is figuring out which of these data to focus on and which ones not to. I'll give you an example. Yahoo, if I went out in my town of Montclair, New Jersey last week and I bought a bottle of red Portuguese wine for $9.99, somebody, maybe my credit card company, maybe Yahoo, maybe somebody else, might have that data that this person in the, what's our zip code, 043, whatever my zip code is, in that zip code bought that bottle of red Portuguese wine. And they might say, you know, we can look and see who else in North Jersey is buying red Portuguese wine. And so they see that there's me in Montclair and three guys in Nutley and four other people in Clifton, and they see the smattering of people who buy Portuguese red wine across North Jersey. And then there's this cluster in Newark, which is 10 miles south of us. And there may be 50 people. So they could say, what do these people have in common? And they have all kinds of other ways to look and see if there's some kind of correlation between where these people travel, how much money they spend, how much money they make, what kind of cars they drive. It's almost endless, the correlations that they can look for among this group of Portuguese red wine drinkers. But does anybody have any idea why that there's such a cluster in Newark? There are a lot of Portuguese people there, right? So you've got the Portuguese people in Newark, and then you've got the people like me that are just looking for a bottle of red wine, and I would have bought Bulgarian if the price had been right, right? So I might not have that much in common with the Portuguese people, but when you have this load, this treasure of data, as these people at Yahoo and the credit card companies and Google, they have, if you spend time looking at all the really cool stuff you can figure out, you can waste a lot of time and dive into what they call rat holes. So that's something that they have to worry about. But nonetheless, they have the tools now, with our credit cards and with our cell phone use and with our internet, to look at human behavior for the first time in history, hour by hour, minute by minute. And much of what they learn is not based on what we say or what someone else says about us. It's what we do. And this is a real change. And I went to Colorado to Umbria Communications. And there are a lot of companies like this, but this one opened their doors to me. This company analyzes millions of blog posts. And they teach their machines to read them automatically. And the machines go through millions of blog posts, and they can determine that a blog post was written by a man or a woman and the approximate age of the of that person. And then they can look at what the people are saying and determine whether the people are favorable or unfavorable. Thumbs up, thumbs down, on whatever they happen to be studying. So if Microsoft wants to know how their new Windows 7 ad, or is it in Windows 7? Yeah, Windows 7. How their new Windows 7 ad is going, they can go to a company like that and they can say, well, it looks like teenage girls last week really liked your ads, but 40-something-year-old men didn't. Now, this is incredibly crude stuff. It's not, I looked at a lot of the results and sometimes they're wrong. The computers don't understand some things. If you say, I can't tell you how much I loved it, the computer has a real hard time with that one. But in areas where you can afford to look at, when you look at big groups and you can afford to misread specific cases, companies can make money by figuring out what's happening, by getting a rough read on what's happening now. Now matters a lot because they'd much rather get a rough read on yesterday than a very detailed read on yesterday 3 weeks from now. And so the trick for the numerati is to figure out areas where they can be wrong a lot of the time and still be right enough of the time to make money. Now, where does truth fall in this? It's not entirely relevant. And I should say, just about Umbria, their analysis of what we're writing is very crude now. It's just, they'd look at me and they'd say 50-something, if they get me right, 50-something male, thumbs down on the new Apple ad or the new Google Buzz. Thumbs down on Google Buzz, maybe. But they wouldn't know more than that. But in the next 10 years, they are going to be able to understand much more of what we write. And they're going to be able to understand each email with a much greater nuanced understanding than they do right now. And so basically, they're taking over the written word as more of the written words are going onto the networks. And so that's another trove of data that's coming in. And they're going to be doing the same thing with the spoken word. So what we say and what we write is going to be analyzed automatically by machines. Now, one area where this is going to have a large impact, I think, is in medicine. I don't know how many of you know about Michael J. Fox. Everybody knows who he is. He has Parkinson's disease. Now, many people in this country have Parkinson's disease, but very few of them left a record, a half an hour every week for a couple decades in his case, his movements and speech can be analyzed. So scientists looking at Michael J. Fox's old sitcoms can see in the mid-90s, long before he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, that he began to walk and talk differently. Now, they don't know that about us because we haven't left those records, but what they want to do is to look at each one of us as if we're Michael J. Fox in 1985 and to analyze us in our lives and to be able to predict what we're going to get before we get it and not just to encounter it when we go to the doctor's office with some problem. Now, you might think, well, how would they ever get that kind of data about me? Well, Intel Corporation in Portland, Oregon, has gotten several hundred elderly couples to let them put sensors into their homes. And they measure everything that can possibly be measured about these people's lives. They measure the length of their strides as they walk through the house. They measure the strength of their voice, how long it takes them to recognize someone they know on the telephone, how many milliseconds it takes them, how they deploy their weight on the kitchen tiles as they're washing the dishes or cooking. The weekly patterns of their movements. They're trying to establish every single behavior that they can as a baseline so that when they see some kind of deviation, some change in those people's behavior, they can know that something is changing and something might be going wrong. And this is just beginning, but with time, what they want is for the computers to have an understanding of the patterns of various maladies so that they can offer a diagnosis of what someone might be getting years before it happens. Now, in the early days, and these are the very early days, the benefits are not from mathematical analysis. The benefits are almost more from surveillance. You know whether somebody got out of how many times somebody gets out of bed in the night, whether somebody goes into the kitchen. They have scales under mattresses so that they can track the weight of people with congestive heart failure. So that if someone gains a lot of weight really quickly, that's a sign perhaps that their lungs are filling up with fluid and you better send an ambulance over there immediately. So this it's much more just alert driven right now, almost like the thing we put in babies' cribs. But sometimes even they can get that wrong. This one woman appeared to gain 9 pounds in the middle of the night in Portland. Anybody guess what happened to her? Yeah, it was a dog or a cat that was on her bed. But you know, I think this type of technology, it may sound far-fetched, but those of you who have elderly parents thousands of miles away, you might not be so disinterested in this technology. Now, let me ask you a question. If an insurance company offered you a 30% discount in your health insurance if you agreed to put several sensors in your homes, how many of you would entertain the idea? I see a tiny smattering of hands. Okay, but how about if they say, hey, this isn't for intrusion. The data is private. We're not going to sell it to anybody. We respect your privacy. But our studies show that in a number of cases, we find strokes before they happen instead of after. In other words, they point to how they can help your health, and it's not just them saving money. Maybe more people would put up your hands. Maybe not. Now, this type of technology that looks at us instead of receiving our reports is spreading beyond medicine into cars. There are insurance companies like Progressive in Cleveland and one in Norwich Union in the UK who offer to put a black box in your car. And they'll give you a discount on your auto insurance if you put a black box in your car that measures which neighborhoods you go through, which dangerous neighborhoods you go through, how fast you accelerate, what hours you drive in the day or night. And what right now, these are the early days, but what they want to come up with is the patterns of motorists and then be able to draw correlations between certain types of motorist behavior and what kinds of risks and what kinds of accidents they get into. And then eventually they would be able to offer us insurance based on our behavior and not on just whether or not we got into an accident or not. How many of you would take a 30% discount in your auto insurance and have a black box put in your car? More. Quite a few. How many of you would have one put in your 16-year-old's car? Now, see, I think what's going to happen is that this surveillance is going to come from my generation, and it's going to go to people the age of my parents and my kids, and it's going to be imposed on people that we feel responsible for. But at the same time, the digital crowd is going to use more of this surveillance technology to monitor ourselves and to optimize ourselves as sleepers, as runners, as athletes, as cyclists, in all these other areas. And more we're going to be developing profiles of ourselves and trying to optimize ourselves with software written by the Numerati. Now, how many people here, I'm assuming most people here have a cell phone someplace within a foot or two of your hand. How many of you have Verizon phones? Okay. Now, what does Verizon, as far as Verizon's concerned, what do all of the people who have their hands raised have in common? There are, excuse me?
They pick the right phone.
Oh, okay.
Can talk to each other for free.
Well, no, they can talk to each other for free, that's true. But the people who raise their hands are from different, racial, economic. If you look at it in terms of traditional groups in America, it represents all different types of groups, I'm sure, without paying much attention to the hands. It's a diverse group, but everybody has something in common beside a Verizon phone, as far as Verizon's concerned. And what they have in common is that they're all here. Now, given that piece of data, Verizon says all those people are right here, right now. Now, let's look at where those people came from. Well, a certain come from one part of town, certain others come from this other part of town. If you look at location, at the way that companies look at websites, this is a website that you've all come to. And they understand us on the internet by looking at the pattern of the websites we go to. If we go to Yahoo, if we go to YouTube, if we go to a specialist thing in archery or whatever, then they start understanding us by the pattern on the web. Now, with the cell phone, they can start looking at the pattern that we describe through the world with our movements. And there's this company that I went to called Sense Networks that analyzes the data of millions of cell phone carriers. They do it, cell phone subscribers. They do it for the carriers. And they introduce this data to computers, and the computers look at this data and automatically begin to group different people just based on their movements, not on their calls. They begin to group the people into different tribes, behavioral tribes. So each person is on the map of New York, and you can see the person, and after 3 weeks, the dot begins to take on a color. And you see that person belongs to the same behavioral tribe as these other people. Now, we don't know who those people are because they have to worry about privacy. But you can start to see the movement of these behavioral tribes through New York. And you can start to see that at nighttime, there are a bunch of blue. The blue dots seem to like Tribeca and Soho. But in the morning, a lot of them are up at Morningside Heights, up by Columbia. And a lot of them sleep in Queens, and a lot of them sleep in Brooklyn. And a lot of them, certain nights of the week, don't seem to sleep at home. And that's another aspect of a tribal analysis that they can do. But anyway, they can start looking at these tribes and look at the geography of New York City or of the world, not based on what landmarks are there or what streets are there, but by what kinds of people go there and what they do. And it's really going to change. It could change advertising, because if you can see that the blue dots hang out in Tribeca at night and have breakfast in Morningside Heights, then you can start putting advertisements for the night spots in the morning places, in the breakfast places in Morningside Heights, and they're going to get much more data, because you can start looking at the dots and saying, where do the blue dots like to take pictures when they're in Paris? Where do they like to eat? What kind of hotels do they like to sleep in? Now again, these are not groups that we know, that we would recognize in the traditional black, white, urban, suburban, Latino mix that we've had for 50 years. This is behavioral tribes. And we are all members of a lot of behavioral tribes, and we're not aware of it. But they're looking at us that way. Now, one thing that Sense Networks came up with, they found that people who appear to be looking for used cars, either to buy or to sell, but people who drive along streets where there are a lot of used car lots and go there more than once are 8 times more likely than average person to change their cell phone subscription. They don't know why, But it's useful data. It's useful data for the cell phone companies. But I'd like to return to back to what we know. There's a lot of garbage in data, and we have to have a garbage strategy for our own heads. Because there's our brain that has all this information that we've had since we were kids, and then there's this big digital network that we're feeding, and it's feeding us, and we've got this symbiotic relationship going on with the networked world. And when I talk about this electronic brain, it's not just one brain; it's a huge ecosystem, and it's everything that reaches, that asks for our attention electronically. It could be an email from a friend, it could be a text message, it could be a cell phone call, everything that comes from that other world and asks for our attention. And we have to think about how much attention are we going to give it? How much of our own data are we going to give it? Imagine if you went off the grid. And a lot of people, when I'm talking about the numerati, say, can I go off the grid and avoid all these people? I say, okay, imagine everybody in the world goes off the grid. Every single entity that lives online shrivels and dies. Google has no purpose if we all stay off the grid. Facebook disappears, Twitter disappears. Our friends would stop emailing us because we're not sending them emails back. They'd stop calling us because we're not answering. The whole world is asking for our attention. And we have to start thinking, and if we turned it off, that big internet just turns into a big calculator in the sky. That's all it is. It would just be doing math then. So if you think about the world, everybody asking for our attention, whether it's an advertisement or somebody calling the phone, they need to get our attention just the way animals or organisms, in a Darwinian sense, need to survive. They need our attention to survive. So how are they going to get our attention? Well, you're sitting there reading the newspaper online, and somebody else wants, they need to get your attention with an ad or a friend or something intrudes, and it has to entice us with a picture or a promise or something to get us to follow it. And when we follow it, we give our attention and we give our data about what we're interested in. And so we feed it. But when we feed it, who's getting smarter? It's getting smart and it's learning about us, but we've been distracted. And are we getting smarter? I think if we look at the big electronic universe that surrounds us in this Darwinian sense, then we can see that, in a sense, it's a big parasite, and it lives off us. And it serves our interest in a lot of ways, but we have to make sure that we understand the value of our own knowledge, our own data, and our own attention. And we have to become masters of that electronic world and not let it master us. And I think that's a challenge for companies and individuals alike. So I thank you very much, and I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you very much for that.
Is it just a coincidence, or are the numerati at work when I go to the grocery store and buy bush-baked beans and get a coupon with my register receipt for Beano?
We've been giving them truckloads of our shopping data for a couple of decades with our customer loyalty cards, and they've been very frustrated because they only recognize us when we get to the cash register. Well, what they want to do is recognize us the minute we step into the store, and then ideally to lead us along a path while we're in the store. And I have a chapter on that in the book.
Are we seeing the demise of newspapers and magazines as we know them? And how will Business Week make money with the new media and internet-free platform?
I should clarify that I left Business Week in December. And Business Week was in, I could go on for hours about Business Week, but it's a very troubled publication, and Bloomberg, which is a data company, bought it on the cheap. And I think that their strategy is doomed, because what they want to do is use Bloomberg's they're turning their backs on the digital world, and they want to use the Bloomberg reporting resources to create a magazine on the cheap and sell it in the old-fashioned way. And I don't think that they're going to be able to do that.
Given what you know about the collection of data, have you changed anything in your life?
No. No, you know, it's the funniest thing, because I write about this stuff, and of course I knew that there was a scary aspect to it, and my editors were sort of interested in the scary aspect, but I'm not that worried about this stuff. And a lot of the promotion of the book is much scarier than I would have had it. Like the British, for example, the British insisted on this subtitle to the book. It was the Numerati, "They've Got My Number and Yours." And then I was horribly insulted, because when the paperback came out, they ditched the Numerati title and just went cut straight to the chase. "They've got your number." So paranoia sells.
Well then, speaking of that, how is government military using this information for national security?
Well, it's absolutely crucial for national security. I mean, we had it's a difficult thing, though, because when the supermarket is looking at us, they know each of us very well, and we have years and years of data about what each individual buys. So we've developed patterns that they can bank on. They do not have a rich set of data about potential terrorist behavior. Luckily for us, we've had very few terrorist attacks in this country, and they've been as different as Oklahoma City and the Twin Towers. And so I think they're really challenged to figure out what would a terrorist behavior look like. And some have come up with cockamamie schemes. There was one story about an FBI agent in San Francisco who wanted to study the consumption of hummus neighborhood by neighborhood, thinking that the hummus might point to increased terrorist cells. Now, you know what's dangerous? We can laugh about this, but what's dangerous about this is that insane ideas like that can get baked into otherwise serious analysis, and then somebody gets a paper that looks like it has all kinds of mathematical rigor, and it looks like, and there's dark red cells in San Francisco, but the assumptions underlying it are ridiculous, and so that's the danger.
Given the use of communications technology to track so much of our whereabouts, why is it that we can't find Osama bin Laden, given all the videotapes he releases?
Well, I mean, I don't know that much about Osama bin Laden, but I have to say that from what I've read, uses techniques that the Romans used. I mean, he talk about going off the grid. He doesn't send that stuff on the internet. He releases it maybe with somebody with a mule that crosses some mountain and is handed through human couriers to eventually get to Al Jazeera or something. So if he were doing it off his cell phone, they'd find him.
Where do you see all this data going, or how far will it go before there are government controls?
Well, that's the big question now. I think that there's a lot of concern about privacy, and I'm concerned that kind of dumb government controls are going to clamp down on this, and basically constrict it. And I think it's a great engine for innovation, and it's really necessary. This data is going to be so valuable in the hunt for cures for diseases and other things and in making us run a much smarter planet in terms of running all of our operations cleaner, more efficiently, and greener. So I think, I hope that whatever rules are put into place will not be too draconian, but I don't know. You know, actually, no, let me amend that. I don't think they're going to be draconian, because the powers that have a stake in this are so big. I mean, if you look at the government and the big companies like Google and IBM and the phone companies, that I really don't think that they will, their lobbyists will let any kind of draconian legislation pass.
Along those same lines, recent and emerging U.S. privacy-related legislation, while well-intended, is aimed at the protection of digital records that contain personally identifiable information. However, predictive behavioral models are a much more serious threat to privacy than any individual electronic record. What is the role of federal governments in regulating how these models are used and who has access to them?
Well, and I think there are already models in place. I mean, the HIPAA statute limits what you can do with medical data and has real controls on that. And I imagine that sector by sector, as we see outrages, there are going to be more laws that regulate it. But I think it's going to be sector by sector.
Cost-benefit analysis. For every one piece of useful data, how many useless pieces of data have you paid for?
Well, I don't know. Anybody have a guess? A million? I mean, I don't really know, but I think that we are going to be producing, each one of us, perhaps 100 times more data in a decade than we're producing now. And so the real key is going to be sifting through all that garbage and not being overwhelmed by it and finding something important about us. Now, as far as us finding important data, that's not really a numerati thing. That's more just a consumer thing, like reading newspapers.
At what point does profit-seeking versus privacy become a valid point? Have we already reached this point?
You know, when I talk to people about privacy, people say they really care deeply about it. And all kinds of surveys show that Americans care deeply about privacy. And the politicians that are in Washington talking about legislation governing privacy are looking at these surveys. But if you ask somebody for data and say that using this data will help them save money, many people will give over their data, including intimate data, to save money. And many people will also do that to save time. And anybody that uses a cell phone is giving up a ton of privacy for convenience. And the other one is, if there's the promise of safety, people will give up all kinds of privacy for the promise of safety. And so this is something that we're going to be juggling for a long time. But I think people tend to overstate the importance that we give to privacy.
Well, then, can you comment on the difference between privacy and anonymity in this digital age?
I don't really know what privacy is. I mean, I think we all feel it when our privacy is invaded. But I think it's very hard to figure out what our privacy is. Let me just talk. There is, with anonymity, a lot of companies realize that every bit of data that they have is potentially a problem for them. Because if somebody hacks into their computers and gets credit card numbers or gets personal information, they get sued and they get into trouble. So one thing that companies want to do is make as much money as they can with the sparsest data that they can keep. They want to boil it down to the stuff that makes money for them. There's this idea that Google, for example, wants to know everything about us. And it's true. Google does want to know everything about us. And they have tons of stuff about us in their databases. But they have to make a calculation of how much work it's going to take to understand, like to put me together. And they'd rather not do that because it costs too much. So a lot of companies like Sense Networks is that company I was telling about that has the cell phone, that covers the cell phone data. They only look at anonymous data because if they only have anonymous data, then they don't get into as much trouble with people if it gets hacked, and they don't get as much bad publicity. And so I think that companies actually want less data, but good data that's worth something to them.
Where is the international center of the conversation regarding privacy as a basic human right?
Well, I would say it's in Europe, someplace between Germany and the UK. And that's where the most heated debate about privacy is happening right now. And but the funny thing about the UK, they're privacy zealots, but they're absolutely surrounded by surveillance cameras. They're every Brit on average gets photographed 14 times a day. And so that's the payoff the trade-off I'm talking about between security and privacy.
You asked us a number of questions regarding whether or not we'd be willing to use surveillance equipment for a discount on insurance or whatever. You never said what you would do. So what would you do and why?
If I looked into the company and trusted the company, I would install surveillance equipment in my house to figure out my health. I've already tried this Zio machine. Have any of you tried out this machine that monitors your sleep? You put this band around your head, and then you put this thing, it's like a clock radio, and it gives you a read of your night's sleep. And you can see when you went into REM and when you went into deep sleep and how many times you got up in the night. And it's really fun. And then you put it up on the net, and it can do a whole graph of the progress of your sleep, and you can compare your sleep to others. I love that stuff.
Well, then that may have answered this question. In the context of your comments, does the future you foresee for your children cause you any excitement or anxiety?
More excitement. I wish I were going to be hanging around longer in this century to see where all this is going, because it's going to be really incredible if we survive.
I'll take that as a hopeful response. In your experiences with businesses, how do you think consumer sentiment can be improved and help us get away from the fear of the financial system in the U.S., away from the current fire drill herd approach to news?
Boy, I think it all starts with education, because I think if we had in an informed population that demanded intelligent, relevant news, then we wouldn't get the trash we're getting. And I lament what's going on right now, because I don't think that most of the media inform us. I think they basically scare us and titillate us, but they don't inform us. And we have to demand something more, and I don't see how it's going to happen. Basically, I have real questions about the market system and information media. It doesn't seem to work.
Given your love of math, have you ever watched the TV show Numbers, and do you see a pilot for the Numerati?
We TiVo that show every week, and my wife says we have to get them to do the Numerati, because they've mentioned other books. They mentioned The Black Swan. They were going to have the Numerati on the show.
We have time for just one more question, but I'm going to join you on the podium
okay.
for that one. First, I would like to present you with our deepest gratitude for joining us here today. I would like you to have this plaque, and thank you so much for giving us your time, sharing your insights, and making us all aware of the behavioral tribes that we belong to that we didn't even know about. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I'd also like you to have this Penn State Forum mug that you can use for Portuguese red wine goes well in it, or whatever beverage you would like.
Thank you so much.
And now for our final question. You note that the Numerati use the information we unwittingly supply through our everyday activities to influence both our purchases and our votes. What exactly do you think they're finding out about us, given that Massachusetts voters just sent a former male nude model to the Senate, and a recent Super Bowl ad featured men singing, "I Wear No Pants"?
I think they know us better than they ever did.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.